The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1. Text now to 51551 or email mooney@rte.ie.
Yes, tough luck on the Irish team today, but they'll be back. I have no doubt they're a great team, the men in green. Anyway, there's an old saying that you can't keep a good thing down, and when that good thing happens to have been the main songwriting talent, and take that, it's hardly surprising that Gary Barlow has kept bouncing back onto our television screens. It's nearly 25 years since Take That took the world by storm with their first number one hit, It Only Takes a Minute. Can you remember it? But it was a year or so later that Gary first showed his songwriting mettle when he took the band to the top of the charts again with his own composition, A Million Love Songs. Phenomenal global success enjoyed by the band is well known to all of us, and now a new talent show on BBC One is looking for 5 performers to play a boy band in the brand new musical that features the music of Take That. The show, devised by Gary Barlow, is hosted by our very own Graham Norton and Mel of Mel and Sue fame. There is another Irish interest, 20-year-old Conor McLaughlin, who's a waiter from Dublin, is one of the competitors. And last weekend, he wowed the judges with this rendition of Elton John's Your Song. And you can tell everybody this is a song. And maybe it was simple, but now that it's done. Conor competes again tonight, and he'll need to be awarded at least 15 points by the judges to get through to the next round. So we wish him the very best of luck. Ireland is with you, Connor. How wonderful life is
now you're in the world. Can you imagine that song was actually written 36 years before Connor was even born? And he's out there singing it and giving it socks. Smelly socks at that. Anyway, the very best of luck again, Connor. It's on BBC One this evening. You'll be able to tune in, find out when it's on yourself. I think it's around or something like that. Because we don't want you switching off here. It's or something like that. So anyway, you can watch it later on. Anyway, thank you for joining us. From one Dubliner to another, Dermot Bulger is a well-known novelist, playwright and poet who is about to shed light on the extraordinary lives of some of Ireland's towering literary giants, legends like Oscar Wilde, James Joyce and Brendan Behan, because the Herald newspaper is launching a series of features about these famous names, and Dermot Bulger has authored the first part of the series. Dermot, you're very welcome to the programme. It's my first time meeting you, though I've heard you a gazillion times on the radio and all that kind of stuff, so it's lovely to meet you. Now, I mentioned, while we know these great names and the names of their great works, we know very little about their actual lives, like the likes of Bernard Shaw. Tell me about him.
Well, Bernard, all fascinating, and all fascinating for different reasons. We lost a great writer in Anthony Cronin just last month, and the paper said that he was 88, but Tony was actually 3 hours away from his 93rd birthday, because, as he often told me, it's a very ageist city, and if you told me your real age, you wouldn't get the gigs. And and even at the age of 91, Tony was looking for the gigs, because that's what writers do. And George Bernard Shaw was 96 years of age when he died, and he died by falling out of a tree, of an apple tree that he was tending to in his own garden. And
that's extraordinary. Is that true?
It is true. And
how did he get into the tree in the first place?
He was a vegetarian, and it says a lot for vegetarianism. So if you get to be 96 and you're vegetarian and you have apple trees, stay out with them is the answer. But he began his career at the age of 15 as a clerk in an office in Molesworth Street. He was from a very prosperous Protestant family in Sing Street, but his father was an alcoholic and the marriage and his business broke up, and Shaw had to go to work at the age of 15 and used to walk around to the National Gallery of Ireland, and he felt that his real university was the National Gallery of Ireland. And when he died, he left part of his estate. So every time My Fair Lady has done somewhere, the National Gallery get a small check.
Well, he described himself as a social downstart. Is that true?
Yes, because everybody else was an upstart, but he actually sort of, his family went downhill. He would have expected to have had a fairly affluent upbringing. He probably would have gone to Trinity College like people like Wilde did and others. But he wound up having to work at the age of 15, went to London to try and make his fortune at the age of 20. And it was, and I think that's possibly why, as I try and explain in the series and try and examine these lives, he was still working at the age of 96.
Because it was in him.
Because it was in him. If, yeah. If you're a self-made man, a self-made woman, I think you never stop.
And no, you always chase the next gig. That's the way it is. You think it's going to end tomorrow, isn't it? Actually, yeah. I remember seeing a very interesting documentary called Tantrum and Tiaras. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's about Elton John. Mm-hmm. It was made maybe about 10 years ago by David Furnish. Isn't that his partner's name, David Furnish? I always tempted to say Furnish when I say that man's name. Anyway.
Elton is one of the famous Dubliners I'm not doing.
Oh, is it? No, but in it, they talk about longevity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would you do if it all ended tomorrow? And he said, it won't end tomorrow. That's not the way it is. I've served my apprenticeship and I will keep going. And this guy just keeps going and going and going and
Samuel Beckett, who I also cover in the series, was asked what he felt his last day on earth would be like. And he said it would be like any other day, only shorter. And I presume, ironically, Beckett had, when he lived in a nursing home at the end of his life, he had a television under his bed, which he never took out except when Ireland played rugby. And he would watch Ireland play rugby and open a bottle of Irish whiskey and watch it. So today, if he was alive, would have been one of the 6 days in the year when he would have broken out the whiskey and the television.
God, I wonder would he have poured it down the drain, though?
I think, you know, Beckett had a very stoic attitude to life, so I think he would have taken out a feat fairly well, you know.
Well, he would have. Yeah, ever tried, ever failed. No matter. Try again, fail better. Anyway, listen, Bob Dylan recently joined Shaw in achieving a unique distinction, and you mentioned Pygmalion earlier.
Yes, in that Bernard Shaw had won the Nobel Prize. He didn't actually want to accept it in 1925, and his wife, who was a very, very rich, affluent English woman, said to him, listen, it would be great for that little nation you're from who've been through a civil war, and it would teach them manners, and it would be very, very good, a civilising effect, if you accepted the Nobel Prize. So he didn't accept the money, but he accepted the award. Yeats was the opposite, because Yeats was a walking poet, and in 1923, when Yeats won the Nobel Prize, and the Irish Times phoned and told Yeats what a great honour it was for the country, Yeats interrupted and said, how much money is it worth? Because he was a very practical man, and then they celebrated with the only thing in the house, which was sausages.
No way. Bangers. But didn't Shaw write a response to the Hollywood producer who tried to haggle with him over the rights?
Well, yeah, I mean, Shaw had an interest in money, and as I explained to Harold, when they tried to bag him down, and they said that it would be a great tragedy if such a work of great art didn't reach a wide public because of mere money. And Shaw telegrammed back and said, dear sir, as a businessman you think only of art, as an artist I think only of money.
And his views on prostitution were fairly controversial for his time.
His views on most things were controversial, and some of them he got very, very right. And he actually sort of Mrs. Warren's Profession. It's about prostitution, yeah. And it was about how women were enslaved by men, and he got that really, really well. He got things like his views on the Soviet Union were totally crackpot, and he viewed Stalin as a great man, and he was totally wrong. So, you know, even great men can get things totally wrong.
So he's full of contradictions.
He was. Well, we're all born on the sign of contradiction.
Now, Transylvania, moving on, it seems like quite away from Dublin, but it's exactly where Bram Stoker created one of the most famous characters in popular culture, and that is Count Dracula.
Well, next Wednesday in the Hill, like, I get to do Bram Stoker, who's a wonderful figure, and he actually, his wife was proposed to by Oscar Wilde, and she dodged a bullet by turning down Wilde and settling for her neighbour in Clontarf, who was 7 years older and was a very, very staid civil servant called Bram Stoker, who'd written only one book, which was a guide on how to be a good civil servant. And Stoker also reviewed plays for an evening paper in Dublin, and when Henry Irvin, the great actor, came over, he was so mesmerised that he abandoned his conventional career and became Irvin's servant for 27 years.
That's a bit bizarre. He went over. Was he having an affair with Irving?
No, he actually just loved the theatre, and he had a very prosperous thing, but when Dracula came out, it was totally stunned everybody, because he just seemed this very, very staid, ordinary guy. But although Transylvania is a long way from Ireland, his mother had grown up in Sligo and had seen, beside the asylum, and seen episodes of cholera and seen people from the poorhouse literally being buried alive and Catholic priests using whips to try and stop the waters throwing people in before into.
And I suppose the famine as well would have impacted on her life.
So although Transylvania and Dracula seems a very, very long way from Ireland, I sort of think that it's informed by the Irish famine, and also that whole class of very prosperous Protestant people who felt that their whole lives were being torn apart. And so there's a whole tradition of, like, the ghost story. Almost every Hammer horror film you ever saw was written originally by a Dublin writer, by Sheridan Le Fanu or by Bram Stoker. And they're all of that Protestant ascendancy class who felt that with Catholic emancipation, their privileged world was slipping away. So you can read it, Dracula, as a wonderful horror story.
The demons within them.
Or you can also read it as a metaphor for how Ireland was changing.
Yeah, but you don't think it's a bit odd? I mean, he's married and he goes off. He meets Henry Irvine, the famous actor, and he goes off. Does he go to live with him? Does he becomes his personal assistant or something?
Well,
like
he becomes
does he
his
the wife. What happens to the wife?
Manager. Well, the wife had a very happy time, but Stoker's mother was a very very social snobby woman, and really felt that the success family was his brother, who became the head of the College of Surgeons in Ireland. But she felt that Dracula had potential to make money, but it didn't make money for Stoker himself. And when he died, the book was virtually forgotten, and any obituaries were about his relationship with Henry Irvine. But after his death, film came in, and suddenly all these versions of Dracula began to appear, and Stoker's wife sued and received $40,000 for the film rights, and did that most very practical thing for a very practical Victorian woman. It was used the money to build a downstairs loo in her house in London, which he called Drac's Room.
It would have been a lot of money then as well, $40,000.
It would have been a lot of money.
Huge amount of money, I suppose. But he never benefited from it himself.
Well, no, because the book had been virtually forgotten. And when he was so linked to Henry Irvine that when Irvine died suddenly, he was out of touch and out of fashion. But, the writers, there's only one part of this Herald series. And I'm going to do eight writers, and then there's going to be eight musicians, and then there's going to be eight iconic Dublin women, and then there's going to be eight political women, and so it's the Herald is 125 years old, and it's a chance really. What I love about the series is that I write about them, but also they reprint the actual pages from, say, last week from when James Joyce died, or when the Oscar Wilde trial, and so it's fascinating to read those old newspapers. And very often when Joyce died, Joyce's death wasn't even the big story in the paper. It was around the tour de force story. And sometimes you read these really small little accounts of...
Why would
men.
That have been, do you think?
Because he was out of the picture. He was regarded with great suspicion in Ireland. And the papers are very... You know, the Herald is the Dublin paper, and it was full of Dublin news. It was two men in Cabin Teely were arrested for coursing on a bus. And you've all these little small stories merged in. So actually, while I love writing for the Herald, and I love reading the big stories, when they reprint these old papers, I love the little... The novelist in me looks at the little stories and says, that's the story.
Well, no,
I really
have to say, if I looked at a page and I saw the death of James Joyce or the death of Oscar Wilde, whatever the case may be, and I saw two men arrested for cursing on a bus in Cabin Teely, I wonder what the curse was, what the conversation was about. Wouldn't everybody, in fairness, we know who the other guys are, we have an idea about them, what kind of things they say, a little bit more colourful. But these fellas, what do they say? So you're covering Wilde as well. I've nothing to declare but my genius. That's a famous quote from him, or is it?
No,
did he actually say it? Everybody believes he did.
Not. He did say some wonderful things. He says, I'll always forgive your enemies because nothing annoys them so much, which I've always tried to apply to life. And he always said to be yourself because everybody else is taken. But the line that he allegedly said to US Customs, I've nothing to declare but my genius, seems to have been invented around 20 years after his death. And when you're famous, very often myths and legends accrue around you, and I think that's just part and parcel of being famous, and things that are attributed to you.
And he never let facts get in the way of a good story.
He never did.
No, isn't that true? Do you get that from his parents? Is that true? Were they
a bit
unconventional?
Well, his parents were very, very flamboyant. His mother once banned somebody from the house because they were described as respectable, and she says only tradespeople are respectable. And she was a flamboyant nationalist poet who never rose before noon. His father was an antiquarian and an eye and ear surgeon who had a very hands-on approach with his patient. There used to be in the 50s, there was a line of not safe in taxis. We used to describe certain types of men that a young woman shouldn't be with. And Oscar Wilde's father wasn't safe in taxis or in surgeries.
Now, the theme kind of running through Wilde's work is the notion of people leading secret lives. He was obsessed by this one. He led a fairly secret life in public himself.
He led,
you know?
And when I was 14, the first adult book I read was A Picture of Dorian Gray. And I knew it was about something, but I didn't know what it was. And then, of course, they're really about being a gay man. in that time when it was, and the consequences for Wilde of being exposed as a gay man were terrible. He served 2 years of hard servitude in Reading Prison and sort of broke
him. He could have avoided
health.
That though, couldn't he?
Well, he could have fled to London. Mm. But when you look at the importance of being earnest, and you look at sort of a lot of his... of his comedies, they're all about men going bunburying, and they're all about secret lives and secret names and identities. And I think you can read them as entertainment, but you can also read them as gay plays.
Where do you put yourself, Dermot, among these famous Dublin writers? Because you're a writer of some note yourself.
Well,
yourself up there with them?
I don't. I'm a man who actually tells stories for a living, and I've got suddenly very old. I just simply tell. I write novels, I write plays, I write poetry. And sometimes when you're asked to write for one of the papers, it's lovely because if you write a novel, it takes 3 or 4 years. But if you're asked to write something for the paper, it's in the paper the next day, and you're meeting people on the street who read your work in that way. And so it's a lovely thing to balance out being a novelist and a playwright, and also then just writing for the national papers. And long may our national papers survive, because they're really important to the culture of a society.
We have a text in here that says, "I think Dermot Bulger is the only genuinely brilliant contemporary writer we have. By the way, Drax Jax sounds better, don't you think?"
Drax Jax sounds like a song that will be sung on Hill 15, you know? If any young Stokers are playing Fianna Fáinne, maybe we'd be singing that one day, you know?
Now, you've adapted James Joyce's Ulysses for a stage production, which is going to be in the Dublin Theatre Festival this year.
It's going to be in the Abbey. I adapted it 23 years ago, and it was forgotten for 23 years. And it's wonderful. And many nights are sold out already. And I think there's a great fascination with Joyce. And people are intimidated by the whole Joyce industry. And at the heart of Ulysses, you actually have these very, very... Leopold Bloom he's Jewish. He's not regarded as Irish in a way that people don't regard black taxi drivers as Irish, even when they're born in Ireland. No, yeah. Bloom is that sort of outsider, and he slays his dragons. He slays enemies one by one. He's lost a child, and himself and Molly are estranged. And there's a very human story at the heart of it. And I just wanted to get to that human story. And bizarrely, it was actually did a tour of China last year. And that was really, really
strange.
Your
adaptation?
My adaptation.
And how did it go?
Ulysses. It went, there's a BBC television documentary about it, and it seemed to go really, really well. Except that every city in China has its own censor. And so in every city they had to come, and we had to take something out. Some little scene or some little line that actually the censor in Beijing didn't like, or the censor somewhere else didn't like. And so I wound up having these really strange...
Can you remember the most innocuous thing you took out?
Well, I can remember the least innocuous. And if we can have this conversation after midnight, I will tell you.
But there's no watershed on radio, so I wouldn't worry about it. Tell me about your dad, if you wouldn't mind.
My father
was a seafarer, wasn't he?
There are two types of men. There are men who actually do things and do brave things. And my father was like that. And they don't talk about them at all. And then there's men who do nothing, like Donald Trump. And all they do is talk. And my father was a sailor on those small Irish ships that sailed to Lisbon during the war. He was bombed 3 or 4 times. This was the only way to bring back vital national supplies. I once asked him, what did you bring back on your last ship, on your last trip to Lisbon? And he said, cork for making stoppers for Guinness bottles and Alta wine. Which don't strike me as vital national supplies, but when you got to Lisbon, you had to bring back whatever you could find. I recently wrote a novel about him called A Lonely Sea in the Sky, but it's not about him, it's about his generation of sailors who actually went out and risked their lives, because British ships sailed in convoys, totally blacked out with destroyers. Irish ships sailed totally alone, totally unarmed. They were tiny, they were only meant for going between Arklow and Dundalk and else, and suddenly they were crossing the Bay of Biscay. And the most famous ship was called the Kerlogan. One day a German plane flew ahead. They presumed they were going to be attacked, as they had been attacked so often before, but instead it signalled SOS. And these Irish men turned starboard, and they encountered 148 German sailors dying in the water. And over the course of 11 hours, they actually slowly brought every man on board. 4 died of their wounds, and the rest came back to Cove and spent the rest of the year in the cover. And for me, it was an extraordinary story to tell, and I just had to understand the world of these men who went out. The minute your ship sank, your wages stopped. If you were on an Irish ship...
Even if you lived?
Even if you lived, if you were from the minute the actual torpedo hit the ship, if you got into a lifeboat, the wage clerk in Stafford's or in Palmgrave or an Irish shipping stopped your wages. And that wasn't an Irish thing, it was a British thing. So these men risked their lives and saw terrible things. And the man who brought my father to sea drowned 6 weeks after the Kellogg sailed all those German lives. A tiny ship called Cymric from Arklow, a little schooner, was sunk, and so many Irish men lost their lives, and they've never really been recognised because we're a bit awkward about our neutrality in Ireland, so they've never really been recognised. And The Loneliest Sea in the Sky was my attempt to try and give them some acknowledgement and to tell their story.
Well, good for you. Now, talk to me before you go about the messenger boy and Yeats. Was that you?
No, people imagine that writers lead very, very extraordinary lives. When I was 15, like Shaw, I actually began walk, and I walked in wire and cable in Unander in Finglas. And because I liked poems, they brought me to meet an old man, and the old man was 65, called Charlie. And Charlie had been a messenger boy. And Charlie used to see this man with a shock of white hair wandering through Dublin, and his arms were flailing out. And he said to a policeman, "Who's that big idiot?" And the man says, "That's no big idiot, that's Willie Yeats, he's a great man for the poems." And 3 or 4 weeks later, Charlie was sent out as a messenger boy to deliver a parcel to Riversdale House in Rathfarnham. And W.B. Yeats, this sort of great august poet, opened the door. And Charlie says, "Oh, here you are, a great man for the old poems." Yeah. And Yeats said, "Who told that? A peeler told me that."
Peeler, yeah.
And Yeats brought him in and actually had lemonade. And Charlie recited part of Julius Caesar to him. And they had this wonderful afternoon. And I think it was a great thing because Yeats, at the end of his life, when he won the Nobel Prize, he was a senator, he was a 60-year-old smiling public man, and everybody treated him with huge reverence. And yet Charlie was just a simple messenger boy. And gradually, I mean, I knew Francis Stewart, who was Yeats' son-in-law almost, and that he was married to Maud Gonne's daughter, Isolde. And he used to say, and Yeats' wife, George, used to have leave a note on the door of the bedroom saying, "Willie, this is not your bedroom tonight," because he would wander around. And these were very, very ordinary men. And they had foibles, and they had, poor Ben and Bean, they had alcoholism and diabetes, which would have killed them. But in the end, they were writers, and they sat down every day and they tried to tell stories that made sense of their world. And well, I think I'm sure that were all writers try to do.
Sure, people are going to really enjoy this. The magazine on Dublin's literary icons will appear each Wednesday with the Herald newspaper, and it's there already, so you can get a copy next week. And then who will be there next week again?
Next week we have George Bernard Shaw, and we have Bram Stoker.
Oh, that'll be great.
And we have Beckett and O'Casey, and we have other, and then it's going to go on.
And then, as you said, musicians and everything else. It'll keep going.
This city.
You'll be dropping dead writing the last one about yourself.
People, you know?
And Dermot Bulger's latest novel, The Lonely Sea and the Sky, based on the dangerous wartime voyages of Irish sailors like his dad, is published by New Island Books at €13.99 and available from all good bookshops. All those details on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Dermot, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
My pleasure, Derek.
Email Mooney at rte.ie.